Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1 p.m. and that is Pacific. No, it isn't. It is Central Time. Sorry. And today being Friday is the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off this week with this graphic of the increase in the debt-to-GDP ratios of various countries in 2020 because it's extraordinary. I don't think most people have a conception of just how much debt has increased over the course of just 12 months. So it's been broken down into household and non-financial corporates and general governments. But you can think about the fact that France's debt-to-GDP ratio increased by 50% in 2020. This isn't like earnings jumping for a company by 50%, which would be a stellar performance. But when a country increases its total debt relative to the size of its economy by 50%, well, the only thing we can conclude is that the cost of servicing that debt in future is going to be higher than it was in the past. But that was not the case in 2020. The vast majority of countries, in fact, saw that the cost of servicing their debt decreased. So they have borne absolutely no ill effects of this massive increase in the size of their debt to GDP ratios. We can see that it was France, Spain, and Greece and the UK were tops in terms of the size of the jump. But the UK's incremental government assistance was in fact smaller than either of those top three countries. Non-financial corporates were very significant in France. Now, when we look at the USA, non-financial corporates did leap into the market and really issued a great deal of debt in 2020 because it was an ideal set of circumstances for any corporate to borrow at extraordinarily accommodative levels. They would have been foolish not to literally just walk out and pick the money up off the ground. And that's exactly what they did. They've been able to stretch maturities. There was an impending waterfall of maturities in the corporate bond sector that was looming in 2021 and 2022. That's not going to happen now. It's going to be pushed out further. So we might be looking at somewhere around 2025 before a lot of this debt starts to mature. Well, that removes a significant headwind from the ability of companies to fund themselves. They don't have to worry about going back to the market to borrow new money anytime soon. Because the cost of servicing the debt was so low, then they don't have to really worry about the coupon payments either. And as long as we're in a reasonably benign environment economically, then corporates are going to be fine. But then we can think about governments. Well, governments have taken on an enormous amount of debt, and governments also have ongoing funding commitments. It's not like corporates where they have visibility on what kind of spending they'll have in a couple of years. Governments are constantly going to the market to issue new bonds, so they are acutely now exposed to any potential rises in interest rates. And we can then think about, if we just look further down the list, that in fact the jump in debt to GDP for both the USA and China wasn't really all that different. It was around the 30% mark. But it's, I think, particularly interesting that China's increase in government debt was, as a percentage of its GDP, was only about half of the increase that the USA did. And the other side is non-financial corporates were much more active in issuing debt, and it was the corporate sector bore much of the brunt of paying for what was required in terms of containing the coronavirus. We can also then look at the fact that the Korean market was pretty even between households and corporates, and then also governments, but nowhere near as much as any of those other countries. But I think it's then particularly interesting to keep going down this list, because we can look at, for example, India, where the government took on a lot of debt, but not so much for either households or corporates. And India is now running a substantial fiscal deficit in order to stimulate the economy. Then we can think about, well, what happened in Japan? In fact, the Japanese consumer was a net saver. So, in fact, Japanese consumers are coming out of this entire episode, or debacle in many cases, of the coronavirus in better shape than they went in. And the government was one of the smallest in terms of how much money they borrowed and deficits they ran. And it's quite interesting that it's countries like Kenya and Egypt are down here at the lower side of the band. They were comparatively unaffected by the coronavirus, but for very different reasons. They've got extraordinarily young demographics, whereas Japan is one of the oldest countries in the world. So that, I think, is a good jumping off point in terms of our discussion about what to expect over the long term. The one thing, too, that I think is worth considering is that banking shares in Europe are starting to steady up. The FTSE 350 banks has first step above the type 2 bottom characteristics. We had the acceleration lower, loss of downward momentum, failed break below 2000, massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And now we're getting a little first step above this base, and it's looking quite favorable. Then we have a very similar chart pattern for European banks. And European banks are now pushing up and into the overhead trading range. It's been quite a while since the European banking sector was exhibiting any kind of strength at all, but it is now pushing up and through that 80 level, which is, I think, significant. What I found also rather interesting is that the kinds of companies that would be associated with the property sector, so for example, Brookfield Asset Management, that's also firming from the region of the trend mean and pushing onto new recovery highs in here. When we think about the reasons why banks and property-related companies might be doing better, well, they are pricing in the fact that there's a reflation underway, that rents are probably going to start to get paid again at some point this year, that there will be some form of debt forgiveness probably somewhere out in the future. But banks in particular tend to do well when there is a wide interest rate differential between the long and the short end of the curve. So the yield curve spread is now up to 123 basis points, and it continues to push higher. If we simply zoom in and look at the daily chart, well, it's continuing to trend. There is nothing on the chart to suggest that there is any measure underway to try and contain this continued expansion. When we then think about government bond yields, well, we are definitely seeing a clear breakout from a well-defined trading range and base formation. And it's running ahead now, up another almost 5 basis points in here today. And the 10-year yield is pushing back up towards that 150 area, our 150 basis point level, which was the lower side of that underlying trading range that persisted between 2012 and 2019. Now, we can think about the prognostications back in 2018 and early 2019 about what the implications would be of the 10-year yield pushing through 3%. Would we be then back in a new inflationary environment, or would that be a Rubicon above which people would truly start to get worried about the debt situation? Or would it represent the end of the secular bull market? Those were all the kinds of arguments that were being made almost 3 years ago. Whereas when we go back and think about what happened in March, we had the exact opposite kind of way of thinking about bonds, that people were very much of the opinion that it was inevitable that the short end of the curve was going to go negative, that the USA would have to go back into negative, or not back into, would join Japan and the EU with negative rates, and that we were going to be in a deflationary environment indefinitely. There was some very panicky reports written by people who probably should know better that we were moving into a depression. And then we can think about what happened next. We've had a meaningful rally in yields. Yields have rallied now by about 80 basis points, so more than a double. And this looks like a base formation completion. If it pushes back above the 1.5% level, well, then it'll be pushing back up into the overhead trading range. We'll be talking about a failed downside break. And investors are beginning to price in the impact on government finances of a reflation. There is certainly a lot more talk today about inflation. Of course, we're definitely seeing a lot of dislocations in the market, and we've had such incredible moves in terms of the economy, and not least because of the complete shutdown in economic activity, that all manner of statistics are out of whack. So to conclude that we are moving into an inflationary outcome, then I think we need to look a little bit further afield and think about, well, what would a new inflationary cycle really look like? What would be required in order to really start to change the perceptions of what exactly we can expect? If we think about what happened with the deflation in Japan, well, people have gone through decades of living a smaller life, and they tend to delay purchases, and they tend to think carefully about any outward sign of conspicuous consumption. And the fashion of people in Japan tends to go one of two ways. Either there's the conformist, where people wear just these very dowdy apparel, and particularly for women, the hemlines are extremely low, are extremely long. Then you have the anime group, which tend to go the exact opposite direction and tend to be rather adventurous in how they dress. That's sort of the rebellious culture. Now, if we can think about our own experience and what we are looking at today, well, we certainly haven't had that kind of smaller living. There's definitely been a drive more towards conserving, spending more time to sort the trash, trying to be more careful and conserving energy. That's certainly been an outpouring of, and certainly there's been this green revolution. And we're definitely seeing that people are talking about there should be smaller houses, more efficient cars, people should just simply consume less. Well, all of that, it's obviously aimed at the argument that we need to conserve energy and use less of it, but it's also extremely deflationary. There's obviously going to be a push and pull in terms of this inflation-deflation argument. The clearest inflationary, I guess, signals that we're getting right now are that people are hoarding. And this is, I think, something that is potentially, I think, a trend we need to monitor, because One thing we can see is that consumers are buying in bulk and they're laying away reserves in case there's going to be a problem, whether that is in response to the pandemic where people had to isolate themselves, or due to weather events, which we've just had, and people will be starting to think about what do they need to have in order to protect themselves from these kinds of weather events in the future. Many people who live in Florida have weatherized their homes. I mean, I've seen houses where there are Kevlar walls or Kevlar paneling on the house to protect it from hurricanes. People are looking at the new Tesla roof panels because they can they heat up a little bit faster, so snow tends to fall off of them. That's certainly something that people will be thinking about as they're looking at electricity variability. Then, of course, we can think about, well, what will be the kinds of investments required to ensure that we're not going to have these kinds of inconveniences. It's going to require a significant amount of investment. And then we can think about supply chains. The one thing that didn't cause any kind of problem last year was IMO 2020. But that was a really significant, I think really important event that happened last year. A large number of ships were taken out of commission. There was a move over to less dirty fuel, and that could have represented a very significant issue in terms of the global supply chain in 2020, and then demand fell off a cliff, so we didn't have that outcome. But as we move back towards reflation, well, then the big question is, are there going to be enough of ships? We've also seen that dock workers, which are heavily unionized, are not working at capacity. They're actively lobbying to be brought to the head of the vaccination program in order to get back to work. So we definitely had some changes in terms of the outlook for the inflationary environment. We're definitely seeing that there is clear money moving towards more renewable energy, and that is going to represent a very significant infrastructure development. The CRB index continues to push higher. It has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs. I think probably not going to get the CCI. They've made that a proprietary index now. It hasn't been updated for all of February, but it had broken out on an equal weighted basis at the end of January. It's being led higher by the industrial resources. Copper prices were up in a dynamic manner in here today. So we're certainly seeing renewed interest again in the inputs for infrastructure development. Copper has been going sideways now for really quite a long time, in a very volatile range, all the way back to the peak, and I think realistically in 2006, it has just taken out the peak from 2006 today. There's a lot of talk going on today about a commodity super cycle. But this is not going to be anything similar to the kind of super cycle that we had in the early 2000s. The super cycle that began in the early 2000s was a different set of circumstances. The first thing that happened was that we had the accession of China to the WTO. So with factories moving there, with access to global markets, China went on an epic building boom, and they threw up skyscrapers like they were paper towers. There's a video online of something like a 30-story building that was constructed in 19 days. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but there were questions then, and there are still questions now about just how long those buildings are going to last, because concrete does not set in 19 days. But that is largely irrelevant at this stage, because China went ahead and did all of that. So it created this incredible demand for iron ore, for coal, for copper and steel, and then also for cement. So China now has got more spare capacity for steel than the entire steel industries of Japan, Korea and Taiwan combined. And that's just their spare capacity. Now, if we're thinking about, well, what's the source of new demand that is going to reignite a commodity bull market? Well, it's not going to be infrastructure development in China. They just don't need it. And certainly China's infrastructure development is going to continue. They're going to continue to build train lines. They've already built an ultra-high voltage power transportation network. So those are things that are already done. They're going to continue in terms of their infrastructure development, but that's not new demand. That's just part of the market today. Where the new demand is coming from is the global initiatives to remake the entire energy infrastructure of the world. So that's a very different scenario. And it is something that could massively increase the demand for copper in particular. Copper is now used in batteries. It will be a much more important component of electric vehicles than it is for internal combustion engines. There is a ton of copper required in a 1 megawatt wind turbine. But of course, we're looking at wind turbines today that are upwards of a gigabyte, and they are almost the same size as skyscrapers. So as we look at the offshore wind sector, then the demand for resources to build those turbines is extraordinary, and it's likely to continue. Then we can also think about the fact that a lot of the wind turbines that were built in the last decade occupied the best locations, whereas today the less benign locations probably require greater infrastructure development to build on. And therefore they have to be even more efficient in order to cover their costs. But the big thing that happened with wind and solar at the end of 2018 and 19 was that they reached cost parity. Now, when we think about hydrogen. Hydrogen is the kind of resource that tends to become popular during any spike in energy prices. But it's becoming more popular today because the range of possibilities with how that it can be created has increased. Historically, the only even semi-economic way of producing hydrogen was by reformulating natural gas. But since natural gas is a fossil fuel, then obviously that isn't going to be acceptable to people that are clear advocates of green energy. There are now hundreds of projects and hundreds of billions of dollars being devoted to new green hydrogen technology, both in terms of consumption and production. The innovation that's occurring in terms of transportation, whether the hydrogen will be mixed with ammonia or whether it can be dissolved into a paste, this is going to make transportation of the fuel much more effective. And then, of course, we can think about its mass and energy. Liquid hydrogen is something that is more energy dense than gasoline by an order of magnitude. So then it also helps to solve one of the main problems with renewables, which has always been that they're not as energy dense as some of the fossil fuels. So when we think then about what the potential is for a step change in productivity growth, then the potential resides in hydrogen because of its energy density. But the question has always been, how can it be used safely and how can it be mass produced? So as we're thinking about, well, where is the source of demand going to come from for a new commodity-led bull market? Well, it could easily then become a hydrogen-led initiative, whether it is going to be in terms of producing hydrogen from renewable sources. So that will be either wind or solar. And for example, they are already doing exactly that with wind turbines in Denmark. Then we can think about what the use cases for hydrogen will be. So hydrogen in terms of fuel cells and as a burning fuel are obviously going to be catalysts. And of course, the catalyst in hydrogen fuel cells is platinum. So platinum prices have broken out in a rather dynamic manner. They have not held the advance all the way through this week, but this continues to look like a breakout overall. I remain very much of the opinion that the easiest way to monitor the preference for renewable energies versus the internal combustion engine is the platinum-palladium ratio. It's been trending downwards for a decade, and it is increasingly looking like this is a breakout that can be sustained for platinum, and it's something that has been underperforming for a long time, and platinum had previously always traded at a premium to both gold and palladium. We haven't been back in the area of this ratio since the massive bull market in palladium in the late 1990s and early 2000s. But it was back then that companies were most acutely involved in stockpiling. And the big automotive companies were stockpiling palladium at the time. They completely gave up on stockpiling during the period from the early 2000s. We had the evolution of the global supply chain. And then because of globalization, we had just-in-time manufacturing. And the most successful companies have been those that have been able to ensure that they can meet their manufacturing requirements by holding very little inventory. And that holding of very little inventory in terms of their supplies and end products, then that's also deflationary. Because one of the most inflationary things we can see in a market is when people start to buy now for fear that they might have to pay significantly more later. And we may just be at the beginning of that for the automotive sector. But the thing is that if companies have to really hold more inventory, it means then that they don't have cash flow, that they have to hold in cash flow in order to ensure that they have enough money to buy that inventory, warehouse the inventory. And that's the kind of thing that can contribute to lower earnings or lower profitability until they can get their warehousing under control. They were afforded the opportunity to massively increase profitability by moving to just-in-time, and they may have to start giving it up. When we look at the debacle, and it really is a debacle for the automotive companies, that they had to do without one of the key components of new cars, which are semiconductors, because they just didn't order them. It's not because the companies producing the chips didn't tell them. We can look at the statements being made by Taiwan Semiconductor. Those companies in the automotive sector were warned 6 months ago that if they didn't make an order, there wouldn't be supply, and they just ignored the warning. But that is also representative of the culture, because these types of cultures don't change overnight. It takes a long time for that kind of culture to change. So companies have been through the pandemic and they've survived by accessing the debt markets. The number one topic of conversation in the second and third quarter earnings calls last year was resilience. Then we can look at what's happened in terms of the automotive sector, and they might have been talking about resilience, but they didn't do anything to become more resilient. Then we can think about industrial metals just as a group. And the LME metals index is breaking higher. I did see an article yesterday talking about lead. I mean, lead has been one of the most benighted of all of the industrial resources. And its use in batteries or as an ingredient in gasoline has been falling for years. But there is now talk of using lead as one of the cathodes in a renewable energy battery. And then it makes them significantly more efficient. Well, lead prices have been going sideways now for a decade. And this is looking exactly like what we see in other commodities, where you get a big bull market and then you get a generational long range until a new source of demand arises. And until that new source of demand pushes the price higher, there won't be investment in new supply. So that's exactly the kind of condition we've had in the oil market. The secular bull market in oil was really in the early 2000s. We had a very significant price appreciation. It went from $10 in 1998 to $140. The world was scoured for sources of new supply, and that new supply was brought online. And since that new supply has been brought online, prices have never got back up towards the $100 level. Now, we had negative prices for West Texas Intermediate for a couple of days in March or April, I think, of 2020. And that was an extraordinary set of circumstances. And it was a significant dislocation in terms of the supply and demand. Now, we can see that some of the major companies are just cutting back on developing new supply completely. And we've seen that a large number of the offshore drillers have gone bust, whether that was Seadrill or Diamond Offshore Drilling. These companies are hanging on by just the skin of their teeth, and there's the potential that they may not survive. Of course, prices are back up to $60. And that was the prevailing level before the pandemic. So oil now is back in an economic area for a substantial amount of that unconventional supply. And they will continue to drill as long as they can hedge out their production. So rather than looking at the front month, what we should be looking at is prices out at least 12 months. So when we think about where prices are in January of 22, well, we're at about $58 or $59. Well, if prices can get up towards 70 on the front end, then we'll probably have prices somewhere around 65 at the long end. And that is high enough for investors to start thinking about how they can hedge out their production and start to increase supply. There's still a lot of people thinking that we're going to have a secular bull market in oil. but they're thinking about the demand side. They're thinking about existing supply. But the one big difference between oil and copper is that we know where the oil is. It's not like we have to go around the world and searching for new sources of supply. There is plenty of oil. If we think about the extraordinary size of the bitumen reserves in Canada, if we look at the size of the offshore potential, the ultra deep water in Brazil, then we can think about the unconventional oil and gas sector in the USA as well. So it's not like we have to find the oil. There is plenty of oil. And we're looking at the potential, certainly, for volatility, because prices are rallying today because there has been less investment in new supply. How could any company justify investing in new supply when prices were negative less than a year ago? So that condition will continue until we see additional new investments. And of course, then the fossil fuel sector has fallen out of favor with large numbers of investors because of the social dynamics. They don't want to be seen to be investing. But tobacco companies are still attracting investor interest. They have been able to, rebrand themselves as cannabis companies, whether that is on the healthcare side or the recreational side. When we think about the significant breakout we've had in the cannabis sector, tobacco companies are playing a part in that because they've got lots of experience with mass producing commodities, and then they also have the labs to create what are effectively addictive products for consumers, and that is helping the entire sector to turn around. We're definitely moving into a more permissive society where there is more tolerance for drug use, there is more demand for leisure time, more demands for wages. Now, those are the kinds of things that are inflating of nature. When people throw caution to the wind, when people start to think about that you only live once and that you should enjoy yourself now rather than save for the future, well, then that is the kind of thing that can start to reanimate the velocity of money. And of course, the velocity of money has been trending down since 1997. Now, there's a lot of arguments about the significance of this and just how it's calculated, but the reality is that it's at levels that haven't been seen in almost a century. So we've had this incredible acceleration lower, and this index goes all the way back to 1942. So we are miles below where the values were at any point. Now, a good portion of that is because of the disintermediation of the internet. But then, of course, we can think about the fact that there is a wall of money that is hitting the markets. The way that Ray Dalio talks about it is that there are three different stages of monetary policy, and that's within the long-term cycle of hard money and soft money. When you think about that book, I'm reading it at the moment, The Fourth Turning, he talks about the kinds of 80-year to 100-year cycles, which is generally a human lifetime. And what they are essentially thinking about, and it's quite similar, so it would, I think, be reasonable to anticipate that Dalio has probably read the same book, that you move through these cycles, and that eventually that history will eventually repeat itself. So as you move into the third phase of money policy, which is very soft money policy and modern monetary theory, then governments will continue to print their way out of trouble. That's why bond yields are starting to rise now. Investors are beginning to cotton on to the fact that we are going to see aggressive money printing in order to try and reignite inflationary pressures. Governments are at a point where the cost of servicing the debt is going to start to pay, or they're going to have to start paying attention to it because bond yields are rising. The bonus that they had from 2020 of low yields against a background of massive issuance, that's not going to be repeated in 2021 without a significant assistance from central banks. And that is true in most countries. So then when we think about the outlook, well, the dollar index continues to look like it is ready to break downwards. It's been quite steady over the course of this year, and it was in negative territory again in here today, but not in a dynamic manner, and it's been really quite inert. And I think that the inert phases that it goes through, they hide the rather dynamic moves that last for about a month at a time, which see steps downwards. The reality is that the dollar does tend to move in cycles, and it has generally a 7-year bull and bear market cycle. So that would suggest that the dollar can trend lower for at least another 4 or 5 years, and then we'll see the next significant low. Now, if that's the case, then international investors are going to start thinking about, well, where can they pick up a yield? Where can they look at somewhere that has an appreciating currency? And where will they be able to pick up the capital appreciation as well? Because the dollar has been weak, and for example, if we look at the pound, it's pushed through the 140 area in here today. It is without doubt benefiting from the accelerated pace of vaccinations in the UK. That the UK will probably come out of the pandemic faster than other countries. But because also the UK was one of the hardest hit by the pandemic, then the swift recovery is really lending it legs. Japan, on the other hand, it was able to avoid most of the pressures from the pandemic. So it broke out earlier, and it is now looking a little bit overbought. The one thing that I think is quite interesting in here this week is that some of the assets that have been doing best over the last few months have started to ebb in terms of their performance. So, for example, the ARK Innovation Fund, there are stories starting to circulate that these types of companies, or ETFs, might actually run out of assets to buy. That's really where the number of SPACs come in. Because the one thing you see in every, in the third stage of a new bull market, or the third psychological perception stage of a bull market, is supply increases. And the number of new SPACs hitting the market is proliferating by the week. And their value continues to increase. And just buying the new ones has been a fruitful exercise. That's also true of the IPOs. So we have two new sources of demand coming through in the market. But they have been doing spectacularly well for quite a prolonged period of time, and it is inevitable that we're going to get some pause of consolidation eventually. Then when we look at the solar sector, and the wind sector, they have stopped rising. And it looks like we are moving into more of a pause in consolidation. And that is regardless of the fact that, generally speaking, oil prices rising would be beneficial for these types of assets. But I think the most important point is that the correlation between renewables and oil has been broken. They are no longer beating the same drum. The outlook for renewables, because they are now profitable, independent of subsidies, means that investment can still continue in the sector. In this regard, it's very similar to the kinds of conditions we see in the shale sector, that as long as they can develop new supply at productive levels, they will. The fact that we're starting to see some pause in terms of the demand for solar and wind probably has more to do with Tesla than anyone is really willing to admit. The share has at least paused over the course of the last 2 months, and it was down again in here today. So it's looking increasingly likely that Tesla is experiencing the same kind of condition from a notable news headline that Apple did back in August. If we think about the big news headline for Apple, it's not so much that they're building a new car and that they are in discussions with LiDAR producers for a potential Apple car at some point in the middle of this decade. The really big headline was that Apple was larger, or had more, was its market cap was worth more than the entire Russell 2000. That was back in August. And I think it is worth considering that when we look at what happened subsequent to that, we had a very significant breakout in the small caps. The big headline for Tesla was that it was worth more than the entire energy sector. Now, I don't particularly think that we're going to see a secular bull market evolve in energy. I think there's too much potential supply. But the reality is that these shares have been priced as if they are literally going to go out of business. And that is just not the case. So there is ample potential that we're going to get a recovery in energy. And that's particularly going to be the case if oil prices push any very much further higher. Then if we think about the fact that the renewable energy sector has paused, what we're definitely seeing is that interest in the copper miners has really taken off. And it is now completing a base formation, and it was up in a really quite dynamic manner in here today. So this looks like the completion of a 7-year base formation and first step above the base for the copper sector. Of course, many people are questioning, well, what on earth is happening with gold? Gold prices peaked in August, and they have been sitting out the renewed interest in the commodity cycle. When we think about the agricultural commodities, they have been resurgent. They continue to break the downtrend that's been in evidence now for a decade, and we're firmer again in here today. So we have agricultural and industrial commodity strength. Silver prices remain firmer than gold, and still holding the region of the peak, down very marginally from the peak put in August. So certainly gold is getting some competition from Bitcoin, and Bitcoin has been absolutely resurgent over the course of the last few weeks. It was up another $2,700 in here today. The Ethereum price is also quite firm and is closing in on the big psychological 2000 level. Well, when we think about gold, it's getting some competition from rising yields. It's also getting some competition from the fact that there is the clear potential that governments are going to have to announce additional measures to support the market. There is the potential that the Federal Reserve, drawing down its significant cash balance at the Fed and flooding the market with liquidity, is going to kick off inflationary pressures. It might also create a problem for finding a home for all that cash in the money markets. These are potential outcomes that could help to reignite demand for gold. But the other big point, of course, is that gold had rallied very impressively in 2018, 19, and 20, that it pushed on to new all-time highs, and now we're getting a somewhat deeper consolidation. Gold does best when it is appreciating versus all currencies. It's not appreciating versus all currencies right now. The strength of the pound means that it's looking rather oversold versus the pound right now, but it has broken down. It has broken the sequence of higher reaction lows, and it is pulling away from that trend mean. So we need to see a clear upward dynamic in order to question that this isn't a new downtrend. But I really doubt that gold is going to fall back below the the $1,200 area. And that was the peak back in 2011, and we are really oversold. Gold does best when it is appreciating in all currencies, so it's not going to go up at the same rate versus every currency. And the pound is having a moment right now because of the UK's virus success. The fact that we're seeing just about every other country other than the USA rally when their currency appreciates, that suggests that that's also one of the potentially confirming factors that could contribute to a new commodity-led bull market. I think it is important, though, to point out that when we think about the Dow Gold ratio, it's looking different to every other cycle, and the Dow continues to appreciate relative to gold. So if we think about this ratio over the extremely long term, then we can think about how it's really moved. I'm going to make it a monthly chart, and then I'll go back to the early 1900s so that we can see just how much of a change we've had in terms of the cyclicality of this market. There's been this significant drawdown in the ratio, and now we're seeing a rebound. If gold is now going to outperform and we're moving into a new secular bull market for commodities, it's going to be a different environment than we've seen previously. Because historically, when oil does well, then it generally tends to act as a tax on consumption. It acts as a tax on growth, and growth moderates. Stocks tend to not do as well because they're contending with higher energy prices, and there are a lot more consumers than there are producers. So that generally tends to see that the stock market does less well. And that's exactly what we had between 2000 and about 2009, where gold in particular did particularly well against stocks. It was rising for 10 consecutive years. Stocks went sideways for the period all the way from 2000 till about 2012. Then the Dow Gold ratio broke its downtrend, and we've seen that stocks have outperformed since then. If we look at the big bull and bear market cycles for oil prices, then they have coincided with bear markets on Wall Street. And then the question has to be, if we are moving into more of a commodity bull market, but not a new secular bull market for oil, well, can then commodities rally at the same time as the stock market? That's a rather large question, because we're in what's effectively an energy transition. The existing energy that we use every day is something that is relatively well contained. The size of the infrastructure development to create new energy sources is not dependent to any great extent on the existing energy infrastructure. So, therefore, do we need to see a very significant ramp up in energy prices? Because that would contribute to a significant headwind. I think this is probably one of the biggest questions that we have right now, because every time we've seen a big bull market in oil, whether that was in the 1970s or in the period from 2000 through to about 2011, then it contributed to a secular bear market on Wall Street. But stocks continue to do well, and most particularly those that are not especially energy intensive. The NASDAQ 100 has continued to push higher. There is absolutely no question that it is accelerating. The pace of the advance has beyond doubt picked up. It is pulling increasingly further away from the 200-day moving average. We can even see that the pace of the advance has picked up in terms of a logarithmic scale chart. So there's a lot of interest right now in this question, because the higher commodity prices go, the greater the potential is that they will act as a tax on consumption, but also that they will have inflationary pressures. And if we do get inflationary pressures and central banks are forced to raise interest rates, well, that's going to contribute to a lot of angst for the high growth sector. So we're in a rather benign environment for everything right now. And central banks continue to follow their mantra that they're waiting for evidence. But what they're really waiting for is for something to break. And when something breaks, that's when they will intervene. But they are, I think, the parallels that we have today with the early 1970s, where we have social unrest, and we have politicians who are literally scared to death of upsetting a rest of population. The potential for any kind of fiscal austerity is just completely off the table. And that pretty much means that they're going all out for inflation. And we're starting to see just the beginning of that starting to turn up in the commodity sector. I can definitely tell you that our family, we have been so happy to be able to leave our home in Los Angeles for a couple of weeks, even though we have been cooped up for long periods of time this week inside our hotel and wondering about when our restaurant's going to open back up again, and how easy would it be to drive around with ice on the road. And yet, just the change of scenery has been enlightening. And as the vaccine rollout persists, as more people get to a point where they can come close to their normal life, people are going to leap back into activity. They are sick to death of this living a smaller life and foregoing the just the normal pleasures of existence. And we're likely to see a boom of epic proportions in terms of people spoiling themselves when we come out of this period of pandemic. And that's going to sow the seeds for inflation. And then we'll see what happens in terms of interest rates. The most important fact is that commodities and banks tend to do well in a higher interest rate environment because they are responding to both the higher interest rate and the potential for price increases as a result of people fearing about inflation and starting to move towards stockpiling. Whereas the valuations of high growth companies are 100% dependent on low interest rates and the absence of a discount rate. But as yields rise, then that introduces a discount rate. And when you start trying to run a discount rate against companies that are trading at a price to sales ratio of triple digits, then you have to start thinking about the fact that they could underperform. And we don't have any evidence of it yet. But eventually something will break. And when it does, then that might be the catalyst for a change or a more pronounced rotation out of the best performers and into the commodity sector that is really only just beginning to break out. I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.